From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents from around the globe. I'm Didi Skanky. This week, the death of a graffiti artist in Syria, seizing assets in South America, and Indonesia's disappearing mangroves. But we start this week's podcast in Pakistan, 1 year after the assassination of Osama bin Laden. A year ago, U.S. Special Forces killed Osama bin Laden in Pakistan's garrison city of Abbottabad. The episode rocked Pakistan's political establishment and provoked widespread rage at what Pakistanis saw as a blatant violation of national sovereignty. Now, 1 year on, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports that while the leader of al-Qaeda is gone, his violent ideology continues to inspire Pakistani extremists.
The legacy of bin Laden is on full view at rallies like this in Islamabad, awash in virulent anti-Americanism. The errant U.S. raid that killed 24 Pakistani soldiers last November has fueled the rage and prompted Pakistan to shut down NATO supply lines. While radicalism parades on the streets, deep suspicion about American motives are also heard in the country's markets. Amid hawkers in this Rawalpindi bazaar, veiled women loaded down with bags wend their way through the pyramid-like piles of vegetables, fruit, and fly-encrusted meat. Shopkeeper Sajid Ahmed says average citizens are deeply offended by the U.S. drone missile strikes on their soil, and says that sentiment has grown the past year. He says the United States should not carry out drone attacks because they are a violation of the sovereignty of Pakistan. He says if they must carry them out, they should do it in collaboration and coordination with the Pakistanis themselves. So you're not opposed to drones. You're opposed to the way they're being used. Is that right?
He's saying, obviously, terrorists are a danger to everyone. They are a danger to America. They are a danger to Pakistan. They must be eliminated.
Fresh MBA graduate Binish Ashraf says the younger generation has become psychologically disturbed by the accumulation of drone attacks, NATO raids, and even the secret raid on bin Laden. All of it, she says, is alienating young Pakistanis from the United States.
Anyone can come and interfere in our country. That's why we are disturbed that we have no future. We have no future in Pakistan if Americans or any other country is continuously interrupting in our country. We want peace only, whether in our country and in America.
Many in this bazaar say that the May 2nd operation was a drama staged by the Pentagon to say bin Laden was dead. They don't consider themselves extremists. Their view is shared by a large segment of Pakistanis and reflects more on the conspiratorial nature of information here. 50-year-old Mushtaq Ahmed says that only a misguided minority of Pakistanis sees bin Laden as an inspirational figure today. He said there are people who do heap praise on Osama bin Laden here, but as far as he's concerned, he was an animal, and he used people for his own purposes. A new survey by the Pew Research Center found that support for al-Qaeda has declined in Pakistan, with 13% holding a favorable view of the organization. Mushtaq Ahmed thinks that militants have also been weakened since the death of bin Laden. 95% of them have been eliminated with help from the Americans and Pakistan's army, he confidently proclaims. Only 5% are left, he says.
That's a very generous view, I must say.
And far from reality, says defense analyst Aisha Siddiqa. She says there may be fewer attacks on the state, but that doesn't translate into a decrease in militancy.
The militancy is there. It has increased. It's not reduced. I mean, forget about Khyber Pakhtunkhwa and the tribal areas. It's happening in the plains of Pakistan. It's happening in mainland Pakistan.
The bin Laden compound in Abbottabad has been demolished, but the mystique of the man remains. A leaking pipe has become a source to some of holy water. Julie McCarthy, NPR News, Islamabad.
The news out of Syria of late has been about explosions and attacks, and whether or not a UN peace plan will work. At the same time, however, there's still a non-violent movement protesting the regime. NPR's Kelly McEvers has been following events in Syria and came across photos of a funeral for one protester, a young graffiti artist named Noor.
They called him the spray man, but really he was just an activist like any other activist. He started protesting in Syria last spring. Back then, everybody thought it would only take a few months to get rid of the president, just like in Tunisia and Egypt. Then Syrian forces started killing protesters, detaining them, torturing them, and the people started fighting back. And now, well, the whole thing has gotten pretty complicated. But still, there was Noor and his friends, organizing protests, hiding activists from the dreaded security forces, ferrying medical supplies to those who were injured but terrified to go to a government hospital. Then, late last year, Noor got caught. Under torture, one of his friends had given up his name. Noor later forgave the guy. He was locked up for 56 days. As soon as he got out, he was at it again. He and his friends went around spraying the suburbs of Syria's capital, Damascus, with slogans against the Syrian president. Down with the traitor. To the trash heap of history. Pictures of the president with the word pig scrawled underneath. A few weeks ago, Noor and his friends declared Freedom Graffiti Week. The Facebook page calls their work a mix of civil disobedience and peaceful expression. It all sounds so harmless, but in Syria, it can get you killed. This past Sunday, Noor was going from neighborhood to neighborhood with his spray paint, jumping from car to car. He sped through a checkpoint for fear of being discovered. He was shot in the leg by security forces. All we know is that he bled to death. He was later filmed on a dark stairwell, his body stiff, his eyes still open. They called him a martyr. The body was washed and shrouded in white and covered with flowers. They came by the hundreds to the funeral. They carried palm fronds and danced around the ones who held his body aloft. Most of them were just dudes. Young ones in skinny jeans and baseball hats. They sang prayers for Noor and his family. Mother of the martyr, they said, we are your children now. Just beyond the crowd, you see a handful of thugs with really big guns. They're not wearing uniforms, but they work for the government. They look just like the dudes at the funeral. Their message is clear. Don't take this any further. Don't take this out of the neighborhood. Then, like so many of these videos that we get out of Syria, the footage of Noor's funeral just stops. The next day, there's another one. Another funeral. Another boy covered in flowers. Another video. We sit in the office and watch. And then we go on to the next thing. Kelly McEvers, NPR News, Beirut.
In South America, a shift towards political populism has led to the nationalization of an oil company in Argentina and an electricity provider in Bolivia. Both seized companies are Spanish. The nationalizations are hitting Spain during a time of deep economic crisis, and as we'll hear in a few minutes from reporter Lauren Freyer, have sparked much anger there. But first to Juan Ferrero in Argentina. The takeovers may have popular support in South America, but they're raising questions about the impact on foreign investment.
It all began here in the Argentine capital 2 weeks ago. There was a rousing speech by President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner about ensuring resource sovereignty. And pro-government groups chanted their approval as she announced the takeover of the energy company YPF, the biggest oil and gas firm in the country. Some analysts, though, are warning that moves like Argentina's are designed more for short-term political gain rather than as a long-term strategy. Before the YPF seizure, the president had seen her poll numbers tumble as Argentina continued to cope with high inflation, capital flight, and a serious money crunch. Among those critical of the government's policies is Claudio Loser, an Argentine economist who's now a consultant in Washington.
This was a movement that is being received very, very well by the general population and even the opposition parties in the country.
But Loser says that Argentina's move could have negative long-term consequences, leaving the country without the capital to develop its oil fields and driving away other companies and investors.
What I would say is that Argentina may not fall into a collapse, but it will sort of fade into mediocrity. And this is already a serious problem in today's world.
There was little criticism, though, in Argentina's Congress. One lawmaker after another praised the takeover in a debate that began yesterday and lasted until just past midnight today.
La situación del neoliberalismo.
José Ciampini, a lawmaker from remote Patagonia where YPF operates, told his colleagues that neoliberal market reforms are on the way out. And he said that by nationalizing YPF, the president was ensuring that the energy industry would answer to the people. Since the president's party controls Congress, it's a given that lawmakers will soon vote to support the president's expropriation. Juan Ferrero, NPR News, Buenos Aires.
As we mentioned, the move to nationalize Spanish companies by the governments of Bolivia and Argentina isn't sitting well with officials in Madrid. Lauren Freyer reports.
Last month, it was Argentina Spanish officials were criticizing. This week, it's Bolivia, which has taken over Red Eléctrica, a Spanish company that owns most of that country's power grid, because it didn't see enough investment. Spain's economy minister, Luis de Guindo, said the takeover will hurt Bolivia in the long run. The Spanish government does not like this kind of decision, de Guindos told reporters yesterday in Brussels. We believe it's essential to maintain legal security in the investment process in countries like Bolivia, he said. Spanish officials say Bolivia and Argentina will pay the price in the long run, as investors become weary of doing business if their assets could ultimately get seized. But Spain stands to suffer as well. The government owns a 20% stake in Red Eléctrica, which it will now lose. Some compensation is forthcoming, but no word on how much. And this couldn't come at a worse time for Spain. One in four here is jobless, the highest rate in Europe. Spanish banks are struggling to survive under the weight of too many bad real estate loans, and that's reverberated through the economy. For Spanish companies with traditionally strong ties to South America, doing business abroad is becoming more important, especially considering the economy back home.
Then some companies, when they're thinking about expanding, for example, in Argentina or Bolivia, they'll think twice.
Javier Vives, an economist at Spain's IESE Business School, says the number of safe places to invest in South America is shrinking. Spanish companies fear their assets could be in jeopardy across that continent.
What will be the impact on many other investments that, for example, Spain has in Argentina or in other countries, which have also populist governments and that may think of an easy way to get quick cash, but then have a long-term investment problem.
Spanish leaders have been lobbying for EU sanctions against Argentina for its oil company takeover. Now the same could be true for Bolivia, though those efforts are still behind closed doors. An EU trade spokesman has issued a statement calling Bolivia's move a negative signal to international investors, but stopped short of announcing any formal punishment. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Freyer in Spain.
Coming up, mangroves on the ropes in Indonesia. This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Dee Dee Skanky.
We turn now to an environmental issue facing the world's tropical regions. Many coastal communities in the tropics have just one line of defense against tsunamis and rising tides caused by climate change: mangrove forests. Indonesia has about a quarter of the world's mangroves, but they're disappearing at an alarming rate. By some estimates, the world has lost half of its mangrove forests in the past half century. NPR's Anthony Kuhn reports that scientists and coastal Indonesians are gaining insight on what's happening and what to do.
The rising tide laps at the feet of local children and fishermen and submerges all but the tops of the mangrove trees. This is the village of Tiwoho in Indonesia's North Sulawesi province. At 1 degree of latitude north of the equator, the climate here is about the same all year round: hot, wet, and perfect for mangroves to grow in. But villagers used to cut down the mangroves for firewood, timber, and to make shrimp ponds. 2 decades ago, farmer Kamal Amani and other villagers began to replant them.
Looking at the mangroves now, I am very pleased. I am very proud of what we have achieved for future generations. And we are very proud of Professor Jamaluddin.
Dr. Rignolda Jamaluddin is a marine scientist at a local university. He's devoted himself to rebuilding North Sulawesi's mangroves one village at a time. He says he's tried to explain to the residents how the mangroves serve as a breeding ground for the tuna and grouper that teem in the local waters, protect coral reefs from sedimentation, and provide an abundance of useful materials that can be gathered without harming the forest.
We can take benefits from the mangrove by not cutting the trees. For example, we make alcohol, we make sugar from mangrove trees.
Dr. Jamaluddin walks over the sandy soil and into the thick underbrush of the mangrove forest. At first glance, all seems silent and deserted. But look and listen closely, and you'll find a microcosm of constant change, cycles of life and death, growth and decay. Some mangrove roots poke upward through the soil to breathe like an ocean full of snorkels. Other mangroves grip the mud with a lattice of roots, like the flying buttresses of a cluster of Gothic cathedrals. All of them have developed filtration systems to survive in salt water that would kill other trees. What's that snapping and popping we're hearing?
I guess that from two sources. The first is kind of crabs, and the second from a mollusk in the mangrove.
Those crabs are not just a tasty link in the local food chain. They're also helping to compost fallen leaves and organic matter, turning them into an underground layer of carbon-rich peat. Daniel Murdiarso, a climate change expert at the Center for International Forestry Research in Bogor, Indonesia, explains.
Mangrove is very efficient living system in terms of sequestering carbon dioxide. They are stored in the leaves, and the leaves will be consumed by the feeders, including crabs and all those microorganisms below the ground.
Murdiarso says that mangroves store 5 to 8 times more carbon underground than above ground. Mangroves account for less than 1% of the world's tropical forest area, Murdiarso adds, but their destruction produces 10% of all carbon emissions from deforestation. There's no doubt that Indonesia's mangroves provide a lot of valuable services, storing carbon, filtering water, and nourishing wildlife. The question is, how much are the services worth, and how can paying for them help protect the mangroves? In Jakarta, Forestry Ministry official Eko Warsito frames the issue this way.
More than 50% of Indonesia's population lives in coastal areas, and most of them are poor. An ordinary plot of mangroves is worth $84 an acre, but if it's cleared and planted with oil palms, it can be worth more than $20,000 an acre.
Eko Warsito notes that some developed countries, including Spain and the Netherlands, have already begun paying Indonesia to plant mangroves. In exchange, they get carbon credits, which they can trade or use as a permit to emit carbon. And, he adds, Indonesia is set to issue a presidential decree outlining a strategy for the sustainable management of its mangroves. Then again, in Tiwoho village, the villagers have restored mangroves without government policies or foreign investment. The fact that the village is in a national park doesn't seem to have helped the mangroves much either. Professor Jamaluddin argues that government management is less effective at protecting mangroves than community-based education.
If the local people have their own strategy, their own knowledge, and the ecosystem already functioning naturally, so then we don't need the regulation like a national park. So just let them manage the resources in their own way.
This is not just the most cost-effective way to protect the mangroves, Jamaluddin says. More importantly, it's nature's way. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Jakarta.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Dee Dee Skanky.